Yeah, so if there are any hard questions, well prepared. You have them too, okay. Maybe I should go and get a carbon dioxide laser or something now. Okay, so thanks a lot for the invitation. Very kind introduction. So it's nice to be here. I've heard a lot about Perimeter Institute, and it's as impressive as I imagined. So I'll be talking about geometric frustration, I'll use that as an excuse to talk about various things which I find interesting in condensed matter physics, new kinds of phases, new kinds of phase transitions that occur. I understand the audience is very diverse. Is there people from particle theory and quantum computing, maybe many other disciplines? Feel free to stop me and interrupt if I'm not making sense. It'll kind of help me understand what I'm getting through also. Right? Okay, so what is geometric frustration? A simple way of defining geometric frustration, let's say you have a physical system which has some interactions, and the interactions are such that they compete with one another. Okay, so you can't satisfy all the interactions simultaneously, and typically what this does, it leads to a degeneracy of states. There are many states that have exactly the same energy. Okay, so we're thinking about a classical system. I give you a configuration of the system, calculate the energy, and it often happens that there are many different candidates for the ground state. Okay, so a trivial example, consider spins. So these spins are either up or down. They're called Ising spins. And let's say they're coupled via this sort of anti-ferromagnetic interaction. Okay, so the interaction wants the spins to be anti-parallel. Put the spins on a square lattice like this. Just let's say the nearest neighbor bonds are the where you have the interaction. You can find this sort of arrangement of spins which makes all the interactions happy. And this arrangement is essentially unique. There's another arrangement which has the same energy, but that's related by a symmetry transformation. Okay, so so we won't talk about those kind of symmetry-related degeneracy. The degeneracy that we'll be interested in, two states having the same energy, we're really going to be interested when that degeneracy is accidental. It's not mandated by any symmetry. Okay, so in contrast, think about spins on a triangular lattice. And you'll see now that you have a problem. You can make these two spins anti-parallel, these two anti-parallel, but you're forced into having a pair of parallel spins. Okay, so you can't satisfy all the interactions identically. And naturally, because of this, there are two different ways of putting the spin that have exactly the same energy. Okay, so that's the degeneracy that we're going to be interested in. Degeneracy here is coming entirely from geometry, the fact that you have this triangle. So if you take this triangle and make it into a lattice, you could use this triangle and make a triangular lattice. It turns out that the number of ground states of this lattice is exponentially large in the number of spins. Okay, so if you have n spins, the number of ground states is this exponential factor. You can kind of see where the degeneracy comes from. It really moves like this one. You can take that spin and flip it. And you can see that, and you can easily calculate that the energy doesn't change. Okay, so there are many states like this that are related by spin flips, but not by symmetry. Okay, they're not symmetry related. Nevertheless, they have the same energy. Okay, there's another kind of lattice you can make out of triangles. It's called the Kagome lattice. Long time I thought this was named after Mr. Kagome, who discovered this lattice, but apparently it's a kind of basket weave that's very common in Japan. So, and people actually saw this lattice and realized it had interesting properties. They called it the Kagome lattice. Okay, so so over here also there are an exponentially large number of ground states, in fact even more than in the triangular lattice. Okay, so you might think at this point, okay, these are nice theoretical constructs. Maybe there are these very large number of ground states, but why is that interesting, and is it actually something that we should worry about if you're trying to describe the physical world? Okay, so it turns out that they are very interesting systems, and it's precisely because of this fact there are many candidates for the ground state. So the system is sort of confused. It doesn't really know which state to pick out. When you sort of take the system and poise it in this way between many different possible states, And I'll try to describe to you the many interesting properties that can emerge, okay, especially when you think about quantum systems. So that's one reason to study these things from the theoretical viewpoint. But in fact, it turns out in nature, these kind of systems are surprisingly common. Okay, so in fact, the example I'll talk a little bit about is the first frustrated system that was described. It's just ice. You just take at ambient pressure, ice is actually a frustrated system. So when people actually measured, in the 1930s, people began measuring very carefully the specific heat of ice. So you can, essentially it's a way of calculating, of measuring the entropy of the system as you go down to very low temperatures. Okay, so the entropy is simply related to the number of configurations of a system. Typically, what you believe is that if you go to zero temperature, go to extremely low temperatures, there's some unique configuration the system picks up. That's the ground state of the system. The log of the number of states is the entropy. Log of one is zero, so the entropy vanishes at zero temperature. Okay, that's the third law of thermodynamics. Now, what these people found when they did this very careful measurement of the heat capacity of ice is that you go to low temperatures. They're not really going quite to zero temperature. They're going down to 15 Kelvin. They find that the entropy was plateauing at this value. Okay, so it appears that there are a large number of configurations that this ice is exploding and is giving you this residual entropy. Okay, so for a while it was, this was confusing, but actually in the same paper they gave an explanation. They went and spoke about this problem to Linus Pauling, and he immediately gave an explanation which actually turns out to be the right one. Okay, so the basic idea is the following. So, ice is just water, two hydrogen atoms, one oxygen atom. And the oxygen atoms form a lattice, these red balls over here. I'll just show a little bit of the lattice. So the important thing over here is that you have this sort of tetrahedral coordination of the oxygen atoms. Okay, and the hydrogens live in between these two oxygen atoms. But there are actually two positions where they could live. They could either be nearer this one or nearer that one. So what Pauling realized is that if this hydrogen is actually disordered and is fluctuating around, it might be leading to this residual entropy. Okay, so he actually came up with a calculation for what the number of such states of this hydrogen atoms could be. In fact, it's not such a trivial problem. If you just look at this, you might think that for every bond, there are two configurations of hydrogen possible. Okay, but it turns out there are some rules that you have to follow when making this ice structure. You have to have two of these hydrogen atoms closer to the oxygen and two further away. And the reason is this has to look locally like a water molecule. Okay, so there are these ice rules, and essentially out of the 16 possible states you can have for this tetrahedron, only six are allowed. Okay. So Pauling came up with this very crude calculation that count all the possible states without the constraint and just multiply it by this constraint factor. It's kind of like a mean field approximation to the number of states. And calculated the entropy, and he got this value. See, it's pretty close to the experimentally observed value. Okay, so the simple back of the envelope calculation you can do, and it sort of gives very strong support to the idea that there are many of these classical ground states that are at play in giving rise to this residual entropy of ice. Okay, now in most systems, what happens is that as you further cool the system, the third law of thermodynamics is obeyed. If it remains in thermodynamic equilibrium, it'll actually select one of these states. Okay, it'll select some particular ground state. Okay, so there are different ways in which this could happen, and in a way it's going to sort of organize my talk as well. One thing that could happen is we have really just thought about, say, nearest neighbor interactions, right, on this lattice, the lattice models I talked about. But in reality, the energy that, the energy function that controls your system is more complex. Okay, there are residual interactions that are also there. And these residual interactions could split that degeneracy. It's sort of an obvious idea. If I think of my frustrated system as some classical potential with two minima, and for some reason these two minima have exactly the same energy, then you can have some residual interactions that breaks that degeneracy by a little bit. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about how, for example, coupling to the lattice can do this. And you'll see as a result, you can get very complex kinds of order. Okay, you really select one of these ground states, but which one you select depends in detail on what these residual interactions are doing. Okay, there's another effect that can select things, which is fluctuations. So for example, if you have quantum fluctuations, if these are not classical particles, but quantum particles, they don't just sit at one position, they kind of explore the neighborhood of that position, and you end up with some zero-point energy. You can think of this as a harmonic oscillator with some zero-point energy coming from quantum fluctuations. In fact, in this particular case, you'll end up selecting this point as the ground state versus that, because when you fluctuate, your energy is raised less than the other case. Okay, so it's a very paradoxical effect. Normally, you think of fluctuations as destroying order. You put on thermal fluctuations, for example, heat the system, you think it'll destroy the order. But in these frustrated systems, you can get the reverse effect. Okay, you can actually get, when you turn up the fluctuations, the order gets stronger, okay, up to some point. Okay, so this will be the sort of the first part of my talk. I won't talk a lot about this. So we have a nice example of this kind of mechanism, which I worked out with a couple of people in the audience over here, Roger Melko and Anton Berkov. But I don't think I'll have time to talk about this. But anyway, there's certainly this possibility that, you know, by various effects, you can lift the degeneracy of these different states and select one of them. Okay. Now, there's actually a much more interesting thing that could happen, which is the following. So imagine that we are actually in a system that has very strong quantum fluctuations. Okay, so it may not even be correct to start with the classical picture and then add the quantum mechanics to it. Okay, but you know, intuitively, what one is thinking about is that you have several of these minima, which at the classical level are all degenerate, but this quantum particle can tunnel through to these different minima. So let's say these tunneling barriers are small, and it can form a state which is a superposition of all the different classical ground states. Right? So so that's a possibility, and you know, in a crude way, that's really what these quantum spin liquids are. So they are states that don't have any order in the conventional sense. You know, they don't pick one of these classical ground states as their ground state. Rather, they are some quantum superposition of all of the different classical ground states. And you know, these states are extremely interesting because not only are they new phases of matter, they actually represent a new class of phases of matter. Okay, and the way in which you describe them, and you know, if you think about what are their characteristic properties, these properties are sort of orthogonal to the regular phases of matter that we know of and we are used to, where you have a simple kind of order used to characterize these phases. Okay, so you know, this is really the holy grail of this field of frustrated magnetism. For experimentalists, is to find an experimental realization of such a quantum spin liquid. And I'll report a little bit about some recent progress. There's still no smoking gun experiment that verifies this, you know, this material is a quantum spin liquid, but there's some interesting candidates. And it'll turn out, it'll also give us ways of you know, describing transitions, phase transitions, which are not described by, you know, which are not possible in, you know, classical systems. Okay, you know, that'll be the last part of my talk. Okay, but to begin with, let me talk about the slightly more mundane physics, where you actually select one of these ground states by, you know, in one way or the other. Okay, so let me describe a very simple mechanism by which you can lift the degeneracy of, for example, of this triangular lattice. So let's say you have various ground states on the triangular lattice, described by these Ising spins, okay, spin up or spin down. So one was, in that case, one was imagining that you just have sites that are spins on those sites, and the sites are perfectly rigid. Okay, so there's no material like that. In any material, this atoms on which the spins are can move. So those are just called, you know, lattice distortions or phonons, if you like. And you see that if you had a configuration like this, this atom would like to move to the right. If it does, it kind of gets closer to this anti-parallel spin. It increases the interaction, gets further away from the parallel spin. Parallel spin decreases the interaction, and you end up gaining a little bit of energy by doing that. Okay, so in any real system, if you ended up starting with, if you started with a configuration like this, lattice would distort a little bit, and you'd end up with something that's slightly distorted. Okay, so then you can ask the question of all the different ground states that you have, which benefits the most from lattice distortion. Okay, and you can make a little model of that physics, and it turns out that, you know, you can prove that the following configuration, blue is spin up, and, you know, open circle red is spin down, that this kind of zigzag state is actually the best configuration once you allow the atoms to move. Yeah, and surprisingly, you know, we found that there's a material, this copper iron oxide, where exactly this kind of magnetic ordering is observed. And you know, we believe that it's really this coupling to the lattice displacements that's at work in generating that particular ground state. Okay, so to further test this idea, what we did was we considered applying a magnetic field on this particular state. Take the Hamiltonian that we had, the energy function we had before, put on a magnetic field, and see how the phase of that system changes. Okay, and okay, so we'll have to work it out. So you know, so this along this direction, you've got parallel spins, so you expand. But along this direction, you contract. So it, you know, distorts the triangle lattice. It probably makes it into, I don't know, maybe a scalene. You know, two of these bonds are the same. It makes it an isosceles.
And the model for this is the button, right?
Yeah. So I can briefly tell you what it is. So normally, if you didn't have lattice displacement, okay.
So this is the same model that was studied by the mathematician at Rutgers, like in the 18th or something. I mean,
I don't know that reference. Maybe you can inform me later. But people have, you know, this is sort of an obvious model to write down for coupling of spins to lattice distortion. And the thing that's important over here is what this restoring force of the atoms are. But okay, that's, so anyway, so we took this model and we generalized it to a more realistic kind of spin. We have vector spins, spins that can point in any direction. Apply a magnetic field, and you start out with this zigzag state in zero magnetic field. And as you crank up the magnetic field, you see these magnetization plateaus. Okay, so this is the magnetization, the total number of spins that are up minus the total number of spins that are down. So in any usual you know, magnetic system, as you crank up the magnetic field, the magnetization follows. It spins like a follow the field. But it can happen that if you're at some special fractions of the total magnetization when everything is up, then the magnetization can get locked into one particular value and not change in a field. Okay, so these magnetization plateaus are somewhat interesting. They're like solids in some ways. You've really made some commensurate pattern and you don't like to change from that. Okay, so we found this magnetization plateau at 1/5 of the magnetization. It has this particular pattern. Kind of looks like a zigzag state, but it's got some new elements in it. And then we also found a 1/3 magnetization plateau. So you get the sequence of phases in a magnetic field. And it turns out that if you look at this material, copper iron oxide experiments on this material, you see the same sequence of phases in a magnetic field. You have the zigzag state, which I already pointed out. You also get this 1/5 magnetization plateau with the same pattern over there. And they also saw a 1/3 magnetization plateau, but they don't know the structure of that yet. Okay, so we have a prediction for what the structure is. Yeah.
Is that diagram on the left an experimental result? Or is
left,
that
is, left is theory, right is experiment. Yeah. So actually, we can match many of these things, the fields at which they occur and so on, quite well.
So,
copper
here,
yeah, it's one, so it's not the magnetic. So it's iron that's magnetic, it's spin 5/2, it's a classical spin. Yeah.
It's iron 3+, right?
It's iron 3+.
It's that kind, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so it turns out that there's also an interesting phase over here in between, which, you know, there are like 40 or 50 experimental papers on this material, and it's entirely because of this intermediate phase over here that people are very interested in. So it turns out that in this intermediate phase, besides having a magnetism, besides having some ordering of the spins, it turns out it's also a ferroelectric. Okay, so it carries a spontaneous you know, polarization. So it's got both magnetism and ferroelectricity. So such materials are called multiferroics. They're ferromagnetic and ferroelectric, so multiferroic. And these materials are extremely interesting to people these days because it gives you a way of controlling magnetism with electric fields. Okay, so we have two kinds of order that are present at the same time. You can use an electric field to change the to change what your magnetism is doing. And so there's an obvious application to computer memories. Okay, so right now the way you write, you store memories, you store bits and you know, up or down orientation of a magnetic material. And the way you write a bit is by running a current and switching the direction of the magnetization. Okay, but that's a wasteful process. You're expending, you're dissipating energy when you do that. If you could do it with an electric field, that would be much nicer. Okay, so there's a lot of interest in these kind of materials, and frustrated magnets give you a natural way of realizing these sort of multiphysics. Okay, you get the kind of magnetic order that typically will couple to the sort of polarization. Okay, so so let me just sort of flash the phase diagram of the system that we found. This is a theoretical phase diagram. This is, in a way, a coupling to the lattice, how strong the coupling to the lattice is. And this is the magnetic field. You see, it's a very complex phase diagram. It's labeled in terms of the magnetization plateaus that you stabilize. There are all kinds of magnetization plateaus present. So, you know, in a way, when you have these frustrated systems, it's quite easy to get these sort of extremely complex orders and phase diagrams. In fact, you know, a referee pointed out to us that our, you know, work couldn't possibly be right because there's a point in this phase diagram where four phases meet. And you know, if you go back to your chemistry textbooks, there's a rule called the Gibbs phase rule that says that you can at best have three phases meeting at a point in this kind of phase diagram. Yeah, that argument is essentially based on, you know, some sort of generic energy functions for three phases. You want to take three numbers and make them equal to one another in such a plot where you have two parameters. You can only do that at one point. Okay, but it turns out that in a frustrated system, you also have accidental degeneracies. Okay, so two of the energies might be equal for no good reason, just because of this frustration. And that's really what leads to this sort of violation of the Gibbs phase rule. Okay, so you get accidental degeneracy that makes, say, two of these phases the same energy, and then you just need to get the other two phases to the same energy. Okay, so you can, so there are some new features and phase diagrams that you get for these in these frustrated systems. Okay, so maybe I can conclude that part. You know, you can get these very complex kinds of orders in frustrated magnets. Because of the connection to these multiferroics, they may even be useful. Okay, so maybe that's blasphemy to talk about something being useful. Okay, so you know, the kind of phases we have been talking about so far, although the orders may be complex, they're ultimately ordered states, okay? So we have a very good way of describing order. So order is just symmetry breaking, right? So you have a certain symmetry in your microscopic Hamiltonian or in your, if you like, in your physical universe. And as you cool a system down, it can spontaneously break that symmetry. Okay? And the way in which you describe broken symmetry is via this Landau's idea of an order parameter. So there's a parameter that characterizes this breaking of symmetry. And if you like, this is really what, you know, if you were to ask a condensed matter physicist, what's the analog of the standard model, you know, of particle physics and condensed matter, you know, it would essentially be these ideas due to Landau that you have different phases of matter. And the way you tell them apart is by broken symmetry. You assign a Landau order parameter that, you know, distinguishes the particular kind of broken symmetry that you have. And, you know, that's all there is to different phases of matter. Yeah, so to give you an example, if you have magnetic ordering, the spins order like this, for example, on the square lattice, there's a Landau order parameter that's simply the direction of the spin. Okay, so of course, the spin direction alternates, so you have to get rid of that alternation by some sign. But the direction of this alternating spin is the Landau order parameter. Okay, it's called the Neel order parameter. Okay, you can have more complex kinds of symmetry breaking. So this is an example. You know, a pair of spins can get together and form a spin singlet. Okay, that's up, down, minus down, up. So now there's no free spin. The spin rotation invariance is not broken. There's no direction you can associate with the spins. Okay, so now if you take these spin singlets and arrange them on a lattice, this arrangement itself can break the lattice symmetry. Okay, so before you made this arrangement, this column and this column were the same. After you make this arrangement, they differ. Okay, so you can also have symmetry breaking of this kind where you break the symmetry of the lattice, translation symmetry of the lattice, and you can capture this kind of order of symmetry breaking by some order parameter too. Yeah, it's called a valence bond solid order parameter. Yeah, now the question that you know, one might ask is in a magnet like this, which you have where you have quantum spins, spin 1/2, Let's say you start at some high temperature where the spins are all have no order, they're in a disordered state. As you cool the system down, the general belief is that you'll end up with some kind of order, you know, either this kind of magnetic order or that kind of solid order of these spin singlets. Yeah, but the really interesting possibility is that you cool all the way down to zero temperature, but the spins don't display any kind of conventional order. Okay, they're not separated from the high temperature state by a lambda order parameter. Okay, there's no order parameter that switches on when you go into this, when you go to the lowest temperatures. Okay, so that's what's called a quantum spin liquid. They're strongly interacting spins, but they don't order. Okay, and it turns out that this kind of state has some extremely interesting properties. You know, just by this definition, actually, you can derive a lot of properties. It's well known to occur in one-dimensional systems. Okay, it's very well studied both experimentally and theoretically. But the real question is, what about higher dimensions? Again, it's really in higher dimensions that they have a lot of novel properties. What about two and three dimensions? One dimension is very singular and particular in many ways. What about two and three dimensions? Can you actually have the situation of a magnet made up of these quantum spins that doesn't order all the way down to low temperatures, okay, zero temperatures? Okay, obviously, the place to look for such systems is in a frustrated lattice. If you had an unfrustrated lattice, there's some obvious orientation of the spins that satisfies the energy function. It's very unlikely that you'll destroy the order, okay, although it's possible. But this is clearly the place to look. This has really been the thing that's been driving this area of quantum, of magnetism, especially frustrated magnetism.
These transitions in general, is it kind of generic that when you get down to zero temperature, things order, or is it, what's the...
Okay, so the reason I actually gave this particular example, there are some cases where you can kind of get a trivial state that doesn't have an order parameter. So to give you an example, take a Mott insulator of bosons. So let's say you have one boson per site. So you cool the system down, it can go into the state where you have exactly one boson per site, or a band insulator for that matter. You know, so that's a state that's separated from the, that's not separated by a phase transition on the high temperature state, but it doesn't have any broken symmetry. And it doesn't have anything else that's interesting in it either. Now it turns out for something like this, the spin a half magnet on the square lattice, one electron per side of the square lattice, you can prove that if you, as you cool to zero temperature, you can't get a boring state. It's either going to break a symmetry like this, or it's going to be in this quantum spin liquid kind of state, which has some very unusual properties. Okay, so there's been a folk theorem for a long time that this happens, but it was recently proved by Matt Hastings, that if you look at the ground state of such a system, for example, on a torus, the ground state can't be unique. Okay, so if you have a degenerate ground state, it's either because you have broken symmetry, so there are two ground states that have related by symmetry, or something else is going on, which is more interesting. So, when you get degeneracy without broken symmetry, that's really this kind of quantum spin liquid. So I'll talk a little bit about that. There's some topological degeneracy. Yeah.
So it's not obvious to me that the valence bond solid on the right, the spin solid, that that has to have order in the way that you've drawn it. Those are essentially little 2x1 dominoes. Why can't I just lay them down in any order? Is that not a ground state of that?
It's definitely not a ground state. I mean, actually, this, so I'm not even talking about Hamiltonians at this point.
Okay.
I can say the same thing about spins, right? I can make any old arrangement of spins, and maybe I can find some Hamiltonian for which it's a ground state. Same way with these dimers, you can find some Hamiltonian which you have some complicated pattern, you can make that a ground state, but I'll actually talk about Hamiltonians, and this turns out to be a very natural kind of state to realize in these quantum magnets. Simple Hamiltonian.
So it's not true that if I were to take, say, this singlet pair and this singlet pair, and instead of having them coupled like horizontally, I could couple them vertically. Yeah. I mean, I don't see why the symmetry. So you've broken the lattice symmetry in a very special way that preserves the order. I don't see why that should be the case.
So when you say, is this natural? The back of your mind, you're thinking about some interaction.
Yeah.
Right. So the question is, what's that interaction? Mm-hmm. So I'll, later when I'll come back to this, I'll show you a Hamiltonian for which this is believed to be the ground state. And essentially, to give you a very brief answer why this tends to be preferred, So these singlets are actually quantum objects, right? So what they can do is they can resonate. So this guy has decided to pair up with this, this has decided to pair up with this, but this can also resonate into a vertical state, right, where this guy pairs up with the guy above and vice versa. So these things can actually gain some kinetic energy that way by doing that. So this is really a caricature. It's not like the ground state is perfectly this collection of singlets. But it can be continuously connected to a state like this. They've got the same symmetry as a state like this. And the reason these kind of states are preferred is because they can do these sort of resonance moves which lower their energy.
But I think the question is, you know, why wouldn't you have one of these spheroid symmetry equivalent ground states?
Yeah, you could. So this is fourfold degenerate. Okay, so you take the whole thing and rotate it by 90 degrees.
Yeah, sure.
Or you translate it by one unit, or rotate and translate. You get four states that are all equivalent.
Okay, I mean, maybe my question just doesn't even make sense, but so if I were to just locally rotate four of these guys 90 degrees, then that breaks the order of the global state.
No, right? It doesn't break the order. Okay, so the way in which you measure an order parameter, so actually, let me do it over here because it's slightly easier to see. What you do is you take, so this is a perfect spin arrangement. Every single spin is doing exactly what you wanted to do. Take one spin and rotate it off at some other angle. So this doesn't break what's called the long range order.
Yeah.
So long range order, you actually take every spin, sum them all up with this phase factor, and divide by the number of spins. Okay, so you're thinking of a thermodynamic system, you know, 10 to the 23 spins. You take one of them and flip them around, it doesn't do anything to this number.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So this is something that only occurs in the thermodynamic limit when you have essentially infinite number of particles.
Yeah.
And you know, so it's, you know, these caricatures are good because you can just look and see that this thing is ordered. And if I actually showed you a wave function that, you know, or even in a classical system, if I showed you the kind of ensemble which has this sort of order, it's not that obvious. You get a lot of different states, and they tend to prefer being like this rather than being in some other state. So you know, this is a caricature of what's really happening. Okay, so in order to think about these quantum spin liquids, this is like a leap of intuition due to Phil Anderson and you know, many years back. So the way in which Phil Anderson, you know, thought about a state that's completely disordered, a state of spin that is completely disordered, is the following. So start with this kind of spin solid where each spin has picked a partner and made a spin singlet. So this is like a crystal of singlets, and they're often called valence bonds. Okay, they're like a pair of spins that are in chemistry that form a bond. So these valence bonds are in some regular order, but if you imagine cranking up the quantum fluctuations in the state, so instead of just having the state, it also tunnels into some other state, and if the tunneling becomes very strong, you could end up in a state which is a liquid of these kind of bonds. Okay, so you have a lot of quantum mechanical tunneling. There's a superposition of all the different possibilities of these pairings. Okay, so I've switched lattices for some technical reason. Don't worry about it. So you know, my way to caricature the state, this is a snapshot of the state, one of the basis states in your wave function. But you know, sometimes this thing is fluctuating to that. There's a lot of these sort of quantum fluctuations. Yeah, that's the kind of state that he envisioned. It's a liquid of these kind of valence bonds. Okay, so Anderson said, you know, why can't we have a liquid of these valence bonds? So that would be a state that has no order, there's no specific spin direction picked out, no breaking of lattice symmetry.
But this is exactly what I was trying to ask, was why can't I have something like that, but on the square lattice? I mean, why can't I have the square lattice have this liquid of...
Yeah, okay, so let me defer that question to after the talk. It's somewhat technical. It's not very important for what we're talking about. But there's an interesting reason why it doesn't happen in square lattice.
Okay.
But you know, usually the objection people have is when I show them this, they say, how the hell can this happen? Why is it always a solid? Right, so it's good that you have the... Now, I have a hard time convincing people that this can happen.
So do you know, when Anderson thought about this, actually this liquid, did he actually also think that maybe there could be the equivalent of the first order transition between a paramagnet and that liquid? Because you could have that.
That can always happen, yeah.
But is there any example where this has been benchmarked in some model experiment where you have...
Yeah, I know an example where you have first-order transition, but you're not...
Below the transition, there's no identified state, identified long-range order state?
Yeah, yeah.
What's the example?
Okay, so if you take... Okay, so if you think of a quantum phase transition between a state like this, so this is called a Z2 spin liquid, and a magnetically ordered state. So if you're near that phase transition, and if you raise, so if you're on the quantum spin liquid side and you raise the temperature, you can argue that that is going to be a first order transition. We can talk about it, but you know, but it's also possible to avert that first order transition. You can go around it. And just like in a liquid gas transition, you can go from liquid to a gas without a phase transition if you're willing to go away in pressure and temperature. So in some sense, they're the same phase, right? So in a similar way, this state is, you know, it could have a first order transition as you heat it up, but it's not required to have any transition. It's not, you know, it can be continuously connected to the high temperature state. Okay, so it turns out that just from this cartoon picture, you can, you know, the theory is constrained enough that you can end up describing a very specific phase of matter that, you know, people have done since 1973. Been a lot of progress in the last 10 years. And we actually know a lot of properties of such a spin liquid state. Okay, and it turns out to have some extremely unusual properties. But, you know, this is like the simplest example of a spin liquid. It's called an RVD, resonating valence bond spin liquid. So let me describe some of its properties, why we think it's interesting. Okay, so the first thing that's different about the state is that if you ask what's the lowest spin carrying excitation you can make, it's spin 1/2. Okay, so in a regular quantum magnet, if it's made of spin 1/2 particles, you know, the minimum spin excitation you can typically make is to take a spin and flip it. Right, so that's actually spin 1. You go from plus 1/2 to minus 1/2. But it turns out that in this phase, you can actually make spin 1/2 excitations. You flip a spin and then you can drag the pair. You know, you take a bond that has a singlet, promote it into a triplet, and then you can drag the constituents of that triplet far away. And the crucial point is that the interaction between this pair is short-ranged. Okay, so it only costs you a finite energy to drag it infinitely far away. Okay, so that's one of the properties of this phase, and it essentially arises because it's a liquid phase. So you take a particular bond, you make it a triplet, and you pull it apart, pull the spins apart. Because it's a liquid, the stuff inside can heal. And you only pay energy near where you make the defect. Okay, so there's only a finite energy cost to make this excitation. Okay, so now you see that, you know, the lowest energy excitation is actually spin 1/2. It's one of these guys. But this is not the same as an electron. Okay, we know an electron has spin 1/2. This is not the same as an electron because when you made this excitation, you didn't add charge to the system. Okay, so an electron comes with spin 1/2, but it also comes with charge. You've got to change the charge of the system. Here, you don't change the charge of the system. It's got exactly one spin per side. Nothing has changed. So it's an excitation that carries spin 1/2, but has no charge. Okay, so it's not really the electron. It's part of the electron. Okay, it's like the electron, which had both charge and spin, broke up into two pieces. One is just carrying spin, and one is carrying charge. Okay, so, you know, since our early education, we have been told the electron is a stable excitation. And that's certainly true in particle physics. If you have the regular vacuum, you have an electron, doesn't decay into anything. Okay, but if you're inside a piece of condensed matter, you're really thinking of a state that's a very high density of electrons. Okay, and that's your vacuum, and you've got to examine whether there are excitations that have lower energy than the electron, into which the electron can decay. And it turns out that in these quantum spin liquids, the electron can actually decay into these constituents, spin-carrying excitation spin-on, and something that carries charge. Okay, now it also turns out you can ask, what is the statistics of these particles? This electron is a fermion, and in this kind of implementation, it turns out that it can happen that these spin-carrying excitations are fermions, and this charge-carrying excitation is a boson. Okay, so you know, this immediately leads you to conclude that in such a state, if you put in charge, the charge can both condense and give you a superconductor. And if you calculate the kind of temperatures you'd expect for this kind of superconductivity, it's extremely high. And essentially, it's because the mass of the electron is so low, they both condense at a very high temperature. Yeah, so then you take an electron, and you take the spin 1/2 excitation over here. Now bring an electron from outside and screen it, right? So the electron spin moment can screen this spin 1/2 moment. The spin is gone now, but you've added charge. So you can combine, you know, if you want to make the charge excitation, one thing to do is to take the spin excitation and, you know, make a singlet with the electron, I'll get a charge excitation that carries no spin.
Before, right? So if you stick in an electron, I can see you're getting rid of the charge, but why haven't I also got rid of all the spin? And compared to what it was, I've got half a spin.
No, it's, okay, so let's say you had no electrons in the system. Let's say you added one electron. You would say that you added charge E and spin a half, right? Now my background is this. This is my background. I have this particular spin. I'm saying this has spin a half. Now I add an electron to it. I add charge, and the total spin is now zero. Okay, so locally over here, the spin zero, charge. Actually, the spin of the electron is sitting here, but it's very far away in this, you know, finite energy. Yeah.
If there are supersymmetric partners of electrons, because you may, normally, you know, it must be more massive, so the electron can't decay to its bosonic partner. Could you make a situation within such a state where an electron could decay to a supersymmetric partner, gathering energy from the solid somehow?
You know, again, this is a very interesting audience, because when I start in a normal audience, when I start talking about this, people say I'm too exotic, right? Say, yeah, this won't happen in any real system, get out. And, you know, okay, it's an interesting question, I think. What, you know, clearly there's some, you've got to modify your thinking when you think about condensed matter systems, because compared to particle physics, because the vacuum can be much more complex. I mean, already in particle physics, it's pretty complex. But here, the vacuum can be much more complex, right?
Well, there is also here a high-energy vacuum, which you have completely integrated out, which are all the protons and the neutrons that make it solid, right?
Right.
And so what are the degrees of freedom, really, ultimately, and how?
Let me say it backwards. I mean, since there is, you know, is it possible that that you could design a solid where a supersymmetric partner of an electron had a lower mass than it does in the vacuum, in the ordinary vacuum? Because
I mean, my guess is that it would have to be a solid of these supersymmetric particles. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, can I get the proton to be lower in mass than the lower in energy than the electron in such a solid? Probably not. Right. I mean, the kind of energy scales you're talking about over here is like electron volts. You can move things
around. I know. But maybe you could put some small amounts.
I see. Okay. Maybe a few electron volts, which, you know, yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's the first property. The second property that I want to mention.
How much time do I have to?
15 more minutes.
Yeah, so it's not bad. So the other property about these quantum spin liquids, it turns out the mathematical description of these states, which is at least the ones we find most convenient, is actually a gauge theory. Okay? So it's a gauge theory in its deconfined phase. So, you know, gauge theory is like what you use to describe electromagnetism or, you know, the various forces in nature.
Is that dimension-dependent statement? Is that only in two dimensions, or is that in general?
In two and three, not in one dimension, though. Not in one dimension. That's why two and three are interesting. You actually get this gauge structure. Again, I don't want to overly emphasize this. The examples we found are described by gauge theories. Maybe there are others that are not, which would be very interesting, actually. It'd be really great to find examples like that. And in some cases, it really looks like this gauge theory of, you know, you're forcing it to describe a state that it's not very natural at describing. But that's the only thing we know right now. So this is really an emergent property. It's not like, you know, in particle physics, you start with the gauge theory, right? And okay, then you couple it to matter and so on. Here, you literally start with spins. You just have spins that are up or down on lattice. You couple them in some way. And that's at the scale of one lattice spacing. Then you go and talk about the system as a whole, look at very long distance physics. It turns out that talking in terms of spins is a very ineffective way of describing long distance physics. Essential properties can be really captured very economically with a gauge theory. So it's the effective theory of the state when you're at long distances and low energies.
Which of these expectations is the quantum of the gauge theory?
I'll give you an So gauge field, you know, let's think of electromagnetism. You've got an electric field and a magnetic field. So I've got to identify for you what the electric potential, electric field is, and what the magnetic field is. So let me sort of make an analogy over here.
But you won't tell us what the photon is.
I mean, I could if maybe when I go. So it turns out the kind of gauge theory over here for the simplest kind of spin liquid doesn't have photons. Okay, so it's a discrete gauge theory. So only when you have a continuous gauge group do you get gauge bosons. In this case, much simpler. You don't have photons, but you do have electric fields and magnetic fields. You know, they are kind of gapped. Their oscillations are gapped. Okay, so to see where this gauge theory comes from, roughly speaking, so I said in order to make these spin a half excitations, you need to be able to separate them by a large distance and yet have just a finite energy cost. Yeah, and it's really because it's a liquid state, you can heal up this this separation. Now, if you try to do that in a spin solid, right, in this kind of valence bond solid, we take a pair of sides, take the singlet and make it into a triplet, make both of them spin up. And then if I drag the spin up away, I'll get a sequence of these green bonds. So that what remains tries to find a partner and pair up. But you see that actually this sequence is misaligned with the column above and the column below, the row above and the row below, right? So if you have a generic model, there's some interaction that likes to keep these things in this parallel state. That's why it has this particular kind of order. If you put in this different kind of order, typically what you'll get is an energy cost that grows linearly with this line. Okay, every new bond you introduce in the wrong place, you get an additional energy cost that you have to pay. So the energy, the interaction between these two spins, the energy cost you take to pull them apart, grows linearly with their separation. Because that kind of reminds you of quarks, right? You know, quarks that have this confining potential, as you try to pull them apart, the energy grows linearly with their separation. Okay, at least it grows with their separation. Okay, so in a spin solid like this, it's not possible to pull apart these spin a half excitations very far. It's like a rubber band, they come back together, right? Okay, so this is really describing a state in the confined phase of the gauge theory where there's this linear energy cost. These spin carrying excitations carry gauge charge. They couple to the gauge field, but here they're confined, and you know there's this linear cost. Whereas here, this is the deconfined phase of the gauge theory. Okay, and you know you can pull them apart, and this you don't keep paying this price as they go further and further away. Okay.
Those are different.
Yeah. You can do it on the triangular lattice.
So there is a confined phase.
Yeah, that's right. There's a confined phase too, where it takes some pattern, but the pattern is so complicated, I don't want to draw it. You know, it's I'd rather draw this. You can kind of think of this as a triangular lattice if you want. Just tilt it all and imagine there are bonds like that. Yeah. No, you could have a deconfined phase at low temperature.
And the confined phase is high.
Okay, so this question of confinement versus deconfinement in two dimensions only makes sense at zero temperature. So, you know, when you talk about these excitations, well, you know, what's the energy cost of pulling them apart and so on, if you're at finite temperature, there's, because of thermal fluctuations, you always get pairs. The whole thing becomes kind of fuzzy. If you want a sharp definition, you've got to be at zero temperature in a quantum mechanical system. Then you can say there's a sharp distinction between this and that.
Is that the special property of a discrete
in two dimensions, yeah. If you're in three dimensions, you can go to finite temperature and give this. Okay, so what? So there's a question, what's the electric field? So roughly speaking, the electric field is this dimer over here. Okay, so you see that, you know, over here, there's this set of misaligned dimers, and that's really like the linear electric field that runs from one charge to another in confined phase and gives you this linear energy cost. So roughly speaking, it's the energy of the dimer, is the location of the dimer, that's where the electric field lives. And if you like the fact there's only one dimer coming out of a site, that's like Gauss's law. Okay, the divergence of the electric field is some charge, the charge is fixed, that's like having exactly one dimer coming out of this. So there's a very simple mapping from this to a lattice gauge theory that one can work out. Okay, and I won't do that, but the kind of gauge theory you get, or you know, it's just like Maxwell's electrodynamics, but the difference is that it's Ising-like. It's a bit like the Ising spins we talked about before. The electric field can only take on two values. It's either there or it's not there, zero or one. the magnetic flux can only take on two values. You know, again, it's either there or not. So the flux sort of lives in these plaquettes. If you take the spin around a plaquette, the phase factor picks up, that's the magnetic flux. You get some quantum fluctuation of these electric field lines. Okay, so here the gauge group is the simplest imaginable, you can simplest group you can imagine, the group of two integers plus and minus one with multiplication. Okay, so that's the second property. You have this gauge field that emerges. The third property is something that was discovered by Xiaogang Wen. It's a natural consequence of having this gauge theory description, and it goes under the name of topological order. Okay, so how do you tell that this state you get, this disordered state, is an interesting state versus some state that just happens to have a unique ground state and no order? Okay, and the distinction is that if you take the system in different topologies, okay, so if you take it on as a flat region, a plane versus a cylinder versus a torus, so these different things are different topologies. The precise geometry of the cylinder or the torus doesn't really matter. It turns out that the ground state degeneracy of the system actually depends on which topology you're in. Okay, so if you're on the cylinder, it turns out this particular liquid state I talked about has a two-fold degeneracy. If you're on the torus, there's a four-fold degeneracy of ground states. Kind of the intuitive way of thinking about these ground states is that if I have a cylinder, you can either have a flux going through the cylinder or no flux. And the flux is really of this emergent gauge field, zero or pi. Okay, so the special property of these ground states, you can have degenerate ground states for various reasons, but if the degeneracy is coming from a symmetry, right, from some symmetry breaking, there's a way to tell that two states, you've got a pair of degenerate states, you can look in local region and tell which state is which. Okay, so for example, if you had an Ising spin system that is polarized up versus polarized down, you can look in a little region of the system and tell if it's up-pointing state or down-pointing state. Okay, that's the idea that you have a local order parameter. You do a local measurement and tell which is which. So these ground states, it turns out, are different. You can't tell if you're in a ground state with zero flux or pi flux unless you go around the whole circumference of your cylinder. Okay, so there's you have to do a non-local measurement to tell in which of these two ground states you are. No local operator will ever tell you whether you're here or there. Yes, yeah.
Cluster in the sense that normally if you have a big system, you can divide it up into subsystems, and each one separately has probabilities factorized. You can take things that are widely separated. Is that something which these ground states are not satisfying anymore?
So this ground state degeneracy depends on the topology, right? So if you have something on a torus, it just has four-fold degeneracy. You can't break up the torus, and if you were to break up the torus, you'll change its topology, right? So the whole degeneracy over here is coming in the different ways in which you can insert this flux, and there's no obvious way of factorizing that.
This is like topological field theory. So phi of x, phi of y is independent of the distance between x and y.
But there's just spins there, right? So if I look at spin correlation functions, and I looked at the, and imagine doing it for separations that are very, very far apart in this particular ground state, is it going to have the property that they factorize, or is it because of
the... Well, the spin-spin correlation function will just go to zero as you go far away. It's spin disorder. Right, it's, the kind of state you're thinking about is something like this, where all the spins are formed singlets. Right? So you look at the spin-spin correlation function in this state, there's a correlation length and it goes to zero exponentially.
Right.
So in order to detect this kind of degeneracy, you can't do it just by looking at the spin-spin correlation function. So there's no way just using spin-spin correlation functions you can tell whether you're here or there.
The reason I'm asking this is that if you kind of ask, if you ask why spontaneous symmetry breaking happens when you have a multi-mx and half potential, you could have said, well, why don't you, tunnel between the vacuum so you have some sort of a superposition of states? And the argument against that normally is that you're demanding, that logically that's a state, but it's almost the same energy as the state,
right?
It has the field on one side. But the criterion for the vacuum that you demand is that it factorizes and it makes clusters. And so you have a cluster decomposition property.
The way I think about that, why there's no superposition state, is that the more spins you have, the tunneling amplitude to go from one state to another becomes smaller and smaller.
That allows you to have the choice. It doesn't tell you which one to choose.
And that's right, yeah.
The thing that tells you to choose is the clustering. And so that's when you have even finite systems like ferromagnets, once you have a large but finite number, then effectively it is clustering, because if you subdivide the system, they're independent of each other.
I mean, the way I think of why you pick one of them is, you know, it's this, if you have a macroscopic system, you can't put it in a superposition, right?
Well, the question is why not, yeah.
The spins typically will couple to the environment, and up and down are very different states as far as the environment is concerned. So if you have a superposition, you'll rapidly decohere into two independent, all up or all down.
So then you expect things to not be correlated in long distances. So I'm wondering,
So here there's an analog of that. The fact that the tunneling amplitude is very small. So that's a crucial part of the argument, right? As you go to thermodynamic limit, the tunneling probability from one minimum of the Mexican hat to the other minimum is very small. It goes exponentially with the number of sites in your system, right? So the analog of that over here is that for this flux to exit the cylinder, you can think of this as a string inside the cylinder that you're trying to pull out. And it turns out that this excitation, this flux excitation, is gapped in the bulk. Okay, so the action cost required to pull it out of the cylinder actually goes linearly with the length of the cylinder. It's the exponential of the length of the cylinder. So there's a small splitting between these two. You can make the symmetric and anti-symmetric combination. There's small splitting between that. And that splitting goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit. Okay, but now you can take any superposition you like of these two states. Because there's no external way of, the environment actually doesn't know which state you're in. It doesn't couple to this because it's some non-local thing. You can have any superposition.
So I'm not trying to sense as to whether or not, so you're giving me a way of choosing, and I'm not sure if it's the choice.
No, I mean, this, it could well be in a superposition of these two, if that's your question. So you're saying, why is one zero, one other pi, why can't I have zero plus pi and zero minus pi, for example? Is that the question?
Well, the question is, if I ask of this state, does it cluster, is the answer yes or no?
No. Think of, say, electromagnetism in the Aronoff Holmes situation. So E squared plus B squared is zero, and you can still have a ground state of the vector potential where the integral of A, that deal around a non-contractible curve, is not zero, but still B is zero and E is zero, so you're in the ground state. This is the Z2 analog of that.
Yeah.
That, I think, clusters, because in the sense of that, there's no correlation that could have done in that system that would have not.
No, because if you can measure the line integral of A dot DL around some closed curve, you can get a non-zero. You can tell what state you're in, but only by doing such a non-local measurement.
Okay, so what I suggest is maybe we can talk about this later. I think there's some communication issue. There's some words I'm not understanding, and maybe something I'm saying is not getting through. Okay, so, but yeah, there was a point raised about Aronoff-Bohm effect. This is exactly the Aronoff-Bohm effect. You have to do an Aronoff-Bohm-like measurement to tell which state you're in. Okay, so people have proposed that this is a great way of protecting quantum information. It's a way for physics to protect quantum information. It's a physics way of doing error correction. Okay, you take a whole bunch of spins, make them into a cylinder. They can encode one quantum bit for you, but they'll do it very well. Okay, so there's no way for the environment to tell whether it's this or that. We've actually got to do this whole measurement. So this is what underlies this topological quantum information proposal. Yeah. It depends. The simplest case, if you go from, the simplest case is described by something like Landau-Ginzburg theory. There's some field that's coupled to an electromagnetic vector potential, and the vector potential has got some dynamics to it. It's a conformal fixed point. Yeah.
But it's conformal.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's described by two-dimensional, in other words, relativistic equals ground state. It's described by conformal field theory. Is that
it's actually relativistic. In this particular case, okay. So I'm more or less out of time. So actually, in recent times, there's been, if you ask about 10 years back whether there are experimental candidates for spin liquids in 2 and 3 dimensions, I think the answer would probably have been no. There's no really good experimental candidate. But today, actually, if you ask the same question, the answer is maybe. Maybe there are some experimental candidates. And really the test that you have to do is you have to make sure that there's no order of any kind in your system. That's the cleanest case. It's actually not a requirement, but it's the cleanest case. You've got to make sure it remains in thermodynamic equilibrium, so there's no freezing. And there's no transition that's separating the state from the high temperature state. Yeah, and also, if you could verify that the spin 1 excitations can decay into spin 1/2 excitations, that's really a smoking gun test of the state. Now, you know, when I talked about spin liquids, I made it very simplistic. The word itself sounds like it's one state. Okay, but actually, it's not. There's a whole class, there's a zoo of states that you can have, and they have very different properties depending on which state you're looking at. But they share this feature that spin 1 excitation can decay into spin 1/2. They share some common features, and that they are disordered. And, but you know, depending on which particular kind of spin liquid state you get, some of them are actually characterized by conformal field theories, or relativistic conformal field theories. But the simple one that I talked about is completely gapped. Okay, it's this RGB spin liquid. Okay, so now we have some examples. On the triangular lattice, there's this example. It's got a typical energy scale of 250 Kelvin. Doesn't order to temperature scales that are 1,000 times lower than that. There's a Kagome example, again, it's got some similar kind of thing, and there's a three-dimensional example that's very nice, hyper-Kagome, which, again, you don't see any sign of order, but nobody has done this kind of smoking gun experiment yet on these materials, so it's still work in progress. There are many things you've got to worry about. So first of all, these things don't look like the simplest kind of spin liquids, this RVB spin liquids, which have a gap to all excitations. They look more like critical spin liquids, which maybe are more interesting states, but they're harder to characterize as well. These things look gapless. Look at specific heat or magnetic susceptibility, there are excitations that go down all the way to zero energy. And there are potential problems, as with any experimental system. There may be impurities that may be, you know, mimicking some of these spin liquid effects. And the spin is not quite conserved. There are various interactions that break the spin rotation symmetry, which also can fool you into thinking that it's a spin liquid. So it's still very much in progress, but you know, if you look at the derivative in terms of how optimistic people are in finding spin liquids in experimental systems, I think the derivative is quite high right now. People are getting more and more. Okay, so maybe I'll. So this was actually this, you know, 2/3 of my talk, but you know, that's fine. That's the tough questions. Let me stop over here. Yeah.
You said there's some candidates for natural systems that might have this, but could you design these type of things in some optical lattice or something? So is the Hamiltonian simple?
So there are some toy Hamiltonians you can write down. So you ask for it to be in a spin liquid ground state, and you also ask that you can solve it. Okay, so that's quite a big constraint. And so it turns out with both those constraints, there are now a lot of models which shows spin liquid ground states. So this is a really beautiful model due to Kitaev, where it's a very natural looking model. So you just take spins on this honeycomb lattice. Okay. So those are the sides of the lattice. The interaction between spins is a little unusual. You say along this bond, the Z component of the spins interact. So this is spin I, psi I, psi j. On this bond, you get, let's say, the X component interacting. So you take this model. This is the Hamiltonian. Every bond, you figure out what the spin interaction is. And you know, don't ask how Kitaev thought of this. But just, you know, take this model. And he shows that you can solve this model exactly. And you can find the ground state, and it turns out to be the Z2 spin liquid. And it's got, you know, spin-carrying excitations, or the analog of spin-carrying excitations that are fermions, actually Majorana fermions, they're like neutrinos, and you know, they're coupled to this gauge field. So there are models like this, and people have talked about how to realize them in an optical lattice. You know, optical lattice work is, I think we still don't understand what are the constraints of making things in optical lattices. So people are very optimistic we can do all these things. But certainly, it's a different set of constraints from what you have for real material, for solid material and solid. So I think it's probably either in a solid state system or maybe in a design system like optical lattice, you find a state like that. Yeah.
Are there candidates for other types of gauge theories, like instead of a Z2,
yeah,
maybe something more interesting like the Abelian group?
Okay, that's really interesting if there's a non-abelian group. But this, you know, halfway thing you can ask, is there a U1 gauge theory?
Yeah.
Right? And it turns out that if we have a U1 gauge theory, we always have compact, in this, you know, physically always compact gauge theories. So if it was pure U1, it would confine in two dimensions. But if you have gapless matter fields, you can have a deconfined state. So actually, that was going to be the third part of my talk, how you could get a U1 gauge, deconfined U1 gauge theory. And that turns out to mediate very unusual kinds of phase transitions. Phase transitions are not possible in classical systems. But you know, in principle, it's possible to get non-abelian gauge groups as well. So there are, you know, ways of treating these quantum magnets where you naturally get these gauge groups. And you can get an SU2 gauge group too in some cases. But you know, people haven't really explored that very much, what happens there, non-abelian gauge groups.
For some of these quantum liquids, in some regions you're saying that they are described by normal field theory.
Yeah.
So what's known, how much is known about
Very little. The only thing that's known about those conformed field theories are large end limits. So, for example, you know, in fact, it's getting more and more urgent to understand those conformed field theories well, because all of these experimentally realized states, you know, they seem to be states with gapless excitations. So, probably one of these critical spin liquids.
So I guess my is a little bit specific question. So if this is a liquid, so it can flow. So is it known what the speed of sound, for example, in this conformal point? So you call it conformal, but more precisely, probably what you mean is gapless. Correct?
Well, some of them are gapless, and some of them are gapless and conformal.
Okay,
so they're actually relativistic conformal field theories. For example, you can get, you know, QED3. So you get Dirac fermions, gapless Dirac fermions, coupled to a U1 gauge field in 2+1 dimensions. Yeah, and so that's a relativistic theory that has conformal invariance. And
but you know, we're talking about condensed matter with a huge speed of sound, right? Because if you truly have a relativistic conformal field theory, then the speed of sound in 2+1 dimensions is 1/2 times the speed of light.
Okay, so here the speed of sound is the speed of light. Okay, so when I say relativistic, it looks like a relativistic theory. You run on the field, go to low energies and look at the field theory you get. It's 1/√2 of what you call the speed of light is, right?
In three dimensions, QED is not conformally invariant.
So this is QED plus large number of gapless Dirac fermions.
So there's a non-trivial fixed point of that in the limit of large n.
Yeah.
You're at that fixed point.
Yeah, right. And it, you know, survives to some finite end. Question is, does it survive to the end that's relevant to condensed matter, which is n equal to 4 in some, you know, some way of defining it? Mm-hmm. So these theories, you can define the large n limit. And you know, even the large n limit is pretty complicated. You know, getting, you know, scaling dimensions of various operators is quite hard. And you know, it's, you know, it really looks like there's some more efficient way of describing these conformal field theories, but we don't really know what that is. You can do you know, numerical simulations, of course, and there's some progress there.
Is that the theory that Parisi and Ken Wilson wrote papers about in the early 70s?
I don't know.
I mean, it's QED in three dimensions coupled to a large n number of fermions.
Yeah, that's what it is. I don't know, you know, who wrote the papers in it. So you know, there are numerics on it by numerical simulations by Kreutz. Mm-hmm. And it's been studied a lot in the condensed matter literature, the large n limit too. So people have classified, for example, what are the monopole quantum numbers and scaling dimensions of monopoles and so on.
Ashwin, is it known how well the spinons will couple to the lattice?
The lattice degree of freedom, you mean?
Yeah, that's right. So with a lot of the experiments, you're going to put heat in through fermions.
I think they will be coupled. So, you know, the killer experiment for many of these states is due thermal conductivity, as you know. You get this very strange effect that it's an insulator, but it has metallic thermal conductivity.
That's right.
You know, just offhand, I think it should be coupled well to the lattice. You know, maybe one could look at a more conventional state, look at a magnetically ordered state, where you also expect some, you know, thermal conductivity. You know, not maybe a one-dimensional a set of spin chains where you expect metallic thermal conductivity, and see if you actually get in trouble that, yeah, in that case.
Let's thank Ashwin for a very enlightening talk.